This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you, in part, by Sundance Now. Sponsors like Sundance Now keep the lights on here at Bladder HQ and in Toby's Roof Shack, and they've got a promo code just for y'all, so keep an ear out for that later in the episode. And that starts right now.
You know, Frank, the culture is not for everyone.
I thought we wound up having a really good discussion, ultimately.
Everything's coming up, Colker. No, the crime we're discussing this week is not, in fact, my singing, but that's an understandable mistake. What we're actually talking about is Wolverine and CJ Craig conspiring to defraud a Long Island school district in HBO's Bad Education, and later, the distinct possibility that the U.S. State Department conspired to support a Vietnamese hit squad targeting journalists in a predictably heartwarming to the point of treacly front line. Just kidding, it's grim. But enough about Alice and Janney's Long Island accent. This is The Bladder Presents, episode 141. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast that analyzes how true crime is told and sold. Taking a break from refilling his Clorox Shotsky is Crime Writers On's Toby Ball. Hello again, Toby.
Hello, how are you?
Not bad. This Lysol teeny is treating me pretty well. Our most wanted topic this week, we are discussing HBO's Bad Education that aired last Saturday, or whatever, as we're recording this a couple days ago on HBO. It should be available on HBO Go for you subscribers. Here's the case file from the film's Wikipedia page, quote, "A Long Island school superintendent and his assistant are credited with bringing the district unprecedented prestige. Frank is a master of positive messaging, whether before an audience of community leaders or in an office with a concerned student or parent. That changes when a student reporter uncovers an embezzlement scheme of epic proportions, prompting Frank to devise an elaborate cover-up," end quote. This one was written by relative whippersnapper Mike Makowski, and co-stars a veritable barrage of Hey, It's That Guys from Charmaine Bucco to Lois from Goodfellas to Annalee Ashford. Bad Education often seems like all the president's election of an American vandal, but I, for one, am not mad about that. This is based on a real case, and I believe the screenplay is adapted from Blotter Presents State Bird Robert Colker's piece for New York Magazine. Toby, were you familiar with this case at all before we dove into Bad Education?
No, I wasn't. I did subsequently read most of the New York Magazine article, though.
Yeah, it was like not a surprise, really, when that title card came up at that Chyron came up at the end, saying that they had taken... they'd taken a lot of the story from the article, or it was based on it. I really thought this was quite good. And I thought that it did a good job getting the exposition about the scheme itself into the screenplay in a way that seemed relatively natural for this kind of thing. What did you think of it overall?
Yeah, you know, I thought it was good. You know, the acting's good. It's well written. I mean, it's a quality movie. I guess my biggest issue was, given that the time that we live in, I wish it had gone a little darker or had a little bit more to say about, you know, our era. Because I think it kind of bounces up against it a little bit, but doesn't quite go there. So it sort of stays rooted in the, you know, the era in which it actually happened.
Right.
Which I kind of felt was like a little bit of a missed opportunity, in that I think you could have, you know, commented on, you know, today and how, you know, I think just kind of like crass you know, wealth issues end up taking precedence over sort of more, you know, noble pursuits such as educating children.
Right. I thought they did a fairly good job at illustrating the, you know, these two things can exist in the same person-ness of Frank Tessone's existence, that he was this skilled sort of, he was a good administrator. He was good and encouraging to kids and teachers, and everyone felt seen and heard by him. But then he was also leading like a couple of double lives. And there were the issues of his sexuality, which I think like on Long Island in 2004, this maybe was a bigger deal than it would seem like to us. But I don't think that's what you're talking about when you talk about like updating it for the present day and drawing parallels. Am I right? You're not, you're talking more about like the, I don't know, United States of scam that it seems like we live in starting at the highest levels. Maybe I'm projecting.
Yeah. You know, when I take a look at this and you take a look at sort of the main characters, and it doesn't seem to me that Tessone is necessarily the bad guy necessarily of all the characters. I mean, I guess he is the easiest person to point to, but for me, you know, it's almost more objectionable are, you know, the school board, for instance, who, you know, it seems like they feel like their responsibility is not to the education of the kids, but it's to real estate values and reputation of the school, and getting the school up bumped up to number one because of what that would mean that, financially.
And getting that synergy so that because it's such a great school district, the home values go up. Excellent segue, Toby, into our first clip. I think that this is one of those places where they're communicating to you what's at stake in a fairly elegant way, given the both frumpiness and like it's a fraud scheme. So it's hard in a scripted property to communicate it without sounding like, without dropping a whole bag of exposition on your actor's toes. And this does that pretty well. Clip two.
We're seeing three bedrooms go for over $1 million in Rosa Nights.
Yeah, you just don't see those kinds of numbers in Syosset or Jericho.
Right, but those towns are a further commute from the city.
Not Manhasset, not Great Neck.
It's the public schools. The better the school system, the higher the price tag on the homes, period.
Our firm has sold 9 separate lots in that area since the report in that journal came out.
And here's a little something, you know, from all of us, okay?
Oh, wow. Really?
Wow.
Keep up the good work.
Well, thanks, everyone. Thanks.
So yeah, that's Hugh Jackman as Tessone. I thought he was excellent. There are a couple of scenes in which his face, like the way his face is like crumbling while he realizes that a scheme is also crumbling is really well done. The young woman who plays the reporter in the on the high school paper is fantastic. I can't wait to see more from her. Also, she like looks like a real person, which is which is a nice change from these like, oh, a 23-year-old sophomore that's with no pores. That's not life. So I liked her a lot. Like I said, Lois from Goodfellas is in it. Ray Romano is in it. You heard him in that clip that we just played. I thought the performances were excellent, but now that you bring it up, I do agree that perhaps they could have gone a little more satirical and darker when it came to the skewing of values in a community like that, and like which priorities would let Tessone just be like stealing a gazillion dollars for however many years and not have anyone really notice.
Yeah, I think I mean, I think there was an opportunity to, you know, draw a comparison between this idea that what's going to vault them from number four best public school in America to number one is building a sky bridge.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that and that's a scam, you know, I mean, that's not actually improving anything about the school. It just, you know, makes it look more affluent. Right.
Right.
So sort of comparing that to, you know, to Sohn, I mean, that's essentially what he's doing for himself, is making him appear more affluent than he actually is. And that with that appearance comes some kind of authority that he uses to his advantage and uses to the district's advantage to kind of project this idea that this is like a top class outfit, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess maybe it was hinted at, and maybe I wanted it more, but, you know, it happened at this one school district. And I think, you know, there was a reason. And I felt like the school board was kind of complicit until, you know, they had no choice but to act.
Yeah. And I think also that you see a lot of this sort of article in New York Magazine, actually, about the vicissitudes of competitive education in New York City and its wealthiest suburbs, that there's always this administrator who, like, at or near the heart of the story, who is in the school but not of the school, if that makes any sense. Like, this is a, you know, this is an educator, this is a middle class person who, you know, has had like decades of experience dealing with the, you know, Bitsies and Chads, but is, you know, on some level is what Edith Wharton would have called a striver. And that aspect of it is sometimes the most interesting, but also the simplest. Like, it's obscure, but it's also a very short distance from A to B in terms of a fraudster's motivations. So that wasn't necessarily explored, and you get glimpses of it. There are little scene snippets where it's clear that this is to project the image of being like these people for whom he works is really important to Tesson. But there's also really a lot of like behind the scenes preparation so that he can keep everyone happy and keep this job. So here's clip three.
Jameson.
Honors English, loves Nietzsche.
Very good.
Yeah.
De Janeiro.
Mel De Janeiro. social studies, ninth grade global history. Oh, American history. Uh-huh. She coaches Little League, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, these are too easy. Oh, here's Tuppy.
Uh-huh.
Todd Hunter.
Oh, shit. Todd Hunter. Mr. Todd Hunter, how's that bowling league shaping up this season?
Oh, we're ahead. But we've got our big match against Jericho on Sunday.
Jericho. I think you'll crush him.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. Mostly, I clipped that for the line delivery of Jericho. I will also note, this isn't the most egregious example, but Allison Janney, whom I revere, this is really a bad and inconsistent Long Island accent. And, you know, you can have people live in Long Island and not be from there and not be steeped in the accent. Like, just let her talk like she talks.
On Crime Writers, Rebecca did a pretty funny little take on all that, because she's from Long Island. She does a pretty good mean Long Island accent, was kind of showing how Allison Janney falls short.
I'm from the landlocked version of Long Island, New Jersey, and the number of people who get that wrong is most. No one seems to understand that it's like, it's just Ray Liotta. That's all it is. We're from the same town. It's not that hard, but also almost everyone in my town is from somewhere else. Originally, you don't have to put quite that much D's and those mustard on it. I think we'll definitely be linking in the show notes to Rebecca's clinic on that, because that was a letdown for me. But overall, although I did really enjoy it, and I was interested to see who was going to show up next, and like Jimmy Tatro from American Vandal is in it. He doesn't have a big role, but it was nice to see him given how much this brought American Vandal to mind for me in good ways. But I think maybe it needed to pick a single point of view here and stay with it, because I think it didn't quite dig into Tessone as deep as it could have. And I thought the parts of it where they follow Rachel as she's sort of realizing that this is an actual story and she's struggling to get the editor to take it seriously and all of that, I thought those were the strongest parts. And I thought a more like all the president's American Vandal take on it might have worked better for the story and might have been more fun and let the tone be both more consistent and a little darker, like you were talking about. Did you have any thoughts on the point of view, or you thought it was fine?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of felt as though the whole sort of subplot of Tessone and his lover out in Las Vegas, which I realize is based on like what actually happened.
Right.
But I felt as though that took time away from the main part of the story that was interesting.
Yeah.
So that to me is kind of, I guess that's life and that's part of the story. And I think they wanted to show sort of this weird combination of deceptiveness, but also sincerity on his part, in that, you know, he's cheating on his, you know, probably like common law husband. I don't know what the legal situation would have been back then.
Yeah. I think domestic partner.
Yeah. But at the same time, it seems like the relationship he had with that younger man is genuine. So I thought like thematically it worked, but unfortunately it was a theme that wasn't so interesting and unique in my opinion. So I do agree. I think if they'd kept it a little more narrowly focused on the school and what was going on in the school, and again, you know, I do kind of feel as though one of the things that was missing is, with the exception of the young woman who's the school reporter, is the student perspective in a situation in which they're really like the way that they're viewed by the people who are running the school district is essentially as, you know,
widgets.
Statistical markers for the community. You know, I mean, they are a means to creating, you know, property values within their community. And I think that it's not that they don't want these kids to succeed, but the great thing about them all going to Ivy League schools isn't, you know, we're turning these kids out with bright futures. It's look at these numbers.
Right.
You know, that we can put on our town annual report and we can give to realtors. So, you know, it would have been to me a more interesting use of time to kind of explore that a little bit more than Frank's like dalliances off in Vegas, which I think must have gotten about 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think so.
In this fairly short movie.
And then there's also a contrasting scene with his, you know, common law husband, the great Steven Spinella, where that relationship feels extremely lived in. And as well, Jackman as Tessone is giving you this like glib unruffledness about the situation, which does indicate a certain like remorseless, not, I'm not going to say sociopathy, but you know, like who actually is this person? Is the performance of, you know, a kind and encouraging ear just that? Is it only a performance? But on the other hand, it did feel like the film was preoccupied with the role that he was playing for the school board and for, you know, Charmaine Bucco, who like tries to hit on him and he's like, oh, you know, I just, it's too soon. Like, did this wife even exist? Why did he feel the need to hide this? Like, I feel like this is a greater preoccupation for the view, for the filmmakers, than it is for the viewers in 2020. And even if this was a bigger deal than it should have been in 2004, I don't think that was a good use of the time. I would rather have spent more time with Rachel, with her confronting her dad about whatever happened that means that he's at home all the time, with their relationship, with her sort of pushing back on the editor-in-chief. I just thought that that also was a really lived-in performance, and this screenwriter's understanding of and recent memory of what high school quote journalism is was like really fond but also scathing. I thought it was great. So I would have tweaked it a little, but I thought there was so much like fun potential in it that that's why I have that critique. I really did enjoy the movie.
I feel the same way, especially about the father, who again, I think there's an opportunity to take a look at least the story he tells is that he was sort of adjacent to a scam and then wasn't willing to turn the people around him in,
right,
for being a part of it. But again, it's like, this is what at least this one adult in this town are doing. He's involved in scams. Like, everything is a scam. And Tassone's thing was that, like, there was the sort of legitimate scam, which was using the school and the kids, you know, for the economic gain of the community. And then there was the illicit scam, which is
billing, you know, 30 grand in dry cleaning.
Right. And just doing, and, you know, having these fake, you know, corporations and stuff. And I don't know. It just seemed like there was a lot of stuff going on there that would have been a pretty easy avenue for something that was a little more biting than what it was.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, it's enjoyable to watch. It's just like one of those things that I kind of felt like they left some opportunities on the floor, which was unfortunate.
Yeah. I think, again, this is a fairly young screenwriter and the director is, I don't know his age, but, I think this is his first feature, and but I see some promising signs. Like, I made a note saying, like, I hope that we actually never find out what Rachel's father did or is alleged to have done, because I think that parallel is too heavy-handed. And then I suspect that they got a note from someone that's like, you have to make this explicit, so that we like invest in them as characters, which, you know, that is my prediction. Typical network note in that situation. And then it was handled really elegantly by the cast and the writing. Like, if you must give us this handholder scene, do it like this. I thought they did it that quite well. And I think that even though this did feel I don't want to use the word derivative, but it did feel like this filmmaking team was steeped in Election, in American Vandal, possibly in Ocean's 11, but definitely the like music cues reminded me of Election. And I just think there were sources to pull from, and I think both of these guys are gonna do well, especially if they can cast Annalee Ashford and Hugh Jackman in things. I just want to play a quick clip of Ashford's character, Jen, who is Allison Janney's scammer character's niece, I believe. She also works in The Office and is trying to bullshit a bullshitter with what she knows, even though she has also used Pam Gluckin's credit card, the company card at Macy's and Lord & Taylor. And Frank Tassone is not having it. I'm not sure that this clip is really going to convey how hilariously uncomfortable this exchange is, so I really recommend watching the movie, but here's clip 5.
I think that I should, think I'm... I know what you all did to Pam. And I could, you know, I could maybe tell people.
Sorry, hold on a second. I'm so sorry to interrupt. I just noticed that necklace you have on. It really compliments your eyes.
Thank you.
It's, yeah, that's new, isn't it? I don't think I've seen you wearing it around before. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, I've got sort of an eye for these things. I don't know. So, what do we think? Is that a Macy's purchase, or are we talking a Lord & Taylor collection?
Special utilities, you said?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, someone's basically been red stapled to the basement a la Office Space.
The acting's really good. I mean, for the most part, I think the movie's good. It's certainly enjoyable. I think part of it is just, you know, I don't know if it's the time that we find ourselves in or whatever, but I find myself wanting to see something great. And I thought this was just kind of really good. But it had the potential.
Yeah.
And that was why in the end I kind of felt, you know, I guess a little disappointed.
Yeah, I can see that.
But again, I was, you know, I told my wife when it came on, I don't know, Saturday or Sunday or wherever, I was like, oh yeah, you should definitely check it out. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, that's what I told my husband. He's like, I wonder what that's actually about. And I was like, I could tell you, but I'm not going to ruin it for you. Yeah. And the fact that I kind of want it to be like 33 and a third short films about Rachel and her editor, like getting in fights about what her piece should be, and then him slowly coming around to her point of view, only means that I thought those parts of it were great. And I thought that this story, like, I would give this an A-. And I think, you know, I'd recommend it, listeners. I think it's a solid hour and whatever it was, 40 minutes. Like, it's not that long. It's a good sit. But it could have been great. And I think Toby's right. It's not quite there. But here's the last clip that hopefully illustrates what I'm talking about in terms of wishing that the point of view had been shifted, like, 15 degrees over to Rachel.
Some of these companies, they don't even exist.
Well, no, you don't know that. I mean, you know that for sure, right? I mean,
Word Power Tech, they've billed the district almost $1 million and no one knows anything. Because it isn't anything. It is a private apartment on the Upper East Side.
Yes, but that doesn't
necessarily... And our superintendent has the key.
Fake.
Come on, Nick, you know what this is. If he hasn't reported this, it's fraud.
He's writing my college recommendation letter. Fuck. Fuck, God damn it.
are we even talking about right now?
It's classic.
Yeah.
It's a great line.
I mean, it's so, and then her face, like the Geraldine Viswanathan is the actor's name, and she's so good. Like the number of like, really faces that she makes. Yeah. Bad Education. It's good. And I'm excited to see what these guys do next, whether it's together or separately, because I thought this was fantastic. Although, you know, when you're working with Bob Colker source material, it's actually pretty hard to fuck it up, especially when Hugh Jackman is saying the words. So we'll see. We'll see what becomes of these crazy kids. But I thought it was really good.
Agreed.
Speaking of really good, that's not how I'd describe this segue into a word from our sponsors, but here we all are together. Life is often stranger than fiction. Maybe that's one reason we're drawn to true crime, the shocking narratives even Hollywood couldn't come up with. One of the reasons I'm drawn to true crime is the same reason I like crosswords and jigsaw puzzles. Filling in all the blanks, putting together the full picture. Whether that's the draw for you, or you're into the psychology of criminals, or new takes on notorious cases, you have to check out Sundance Now, because Sundance Now will have something for you. Sundance Now is a commercial-free streaming service brought to you by the folks at AMC Network, so if you love their groundbreaking storytelling, you'll love Sundance Now, and its killer selection, don't get up, I'll fire myself, of true crime series you won't find anywhere else. Sundance Now's docuseries cover everything from the unheard of to the infamous, like No One Saw a Thing, a series on the unsolved death of small-town bully Ken Rex McElroy that's one of American history's most storied acts of vigilantism, or Jonestown, Terror in the Jungle, executive produced by Leonardo DiCaprio, or a property I thought more people should have watched when it originally aired, Joe Berlinger's cold-blooded The Clutter Family Murders, on the case that created a genre within Cold Blood. And there's plenty of scripted fare for true crime fans to binge as well, including Law & Order UK and Leverage, one of my favorite processy shows that's not too heavy, so I can just grab an episode on my phone before bedtime. Did I mention that you can watch Sundance Now on all your favorite devices? Because you can. Just download the app or watch online. And you can get Sundance Now, for as low as $4.99 a month, a steal for all that exclusive content. Check it all out and discover your next binge-worthy show on Sundance Now. Try it free for 30 days by going to sundancenow.com with my promo code BLOTTER. That's sundancenow.com, code BLOTTER, to get your first 30 days of Sundance Now for free. Thanks, Sundance Now. All right, moving along to our ultra-cheery cold case. Although, given that this is a frontline, it could have been worse. We are talking about the November 3rd, 2015 episode, Terror in Little Saigon. Here's the case file from PBS's landing page, quote, Frontline and ProPublica team up to investigate a wave of terror that targeted Vietnamese-American journalists. Uncovering a trail that leads from American cities to jungles in Southeast Asia, Frontline and ProPublica shine new light on a series of unsolved murders and attacks. End quote. I'm not sure why they had to drag the jungles into it. I feel like the reporter meets everyone at a cafe. Like, I get it,
right.
But this is the writing generally in this thing struck me as a little melodramatic. I don't know, like. It's Frontline. It's never going to be like shitty, but overall, I kind of felt lectured in a way I usually don't. But Toby, this was your selection. So do you want to talk a little bit about what led you to this topic?
Uh-oh. what led me to the topic is I went to Frontline and took a look at their crime, went through their crime properties. And knowing that we'd already done a few, this looked promising. And part of the reason why is I think I'm kind of personally interested in these sort of expat communities in the US
mm-hmm.
that sort of have their – the politics of their home country play out, you know, in the U.S. And you know, I think for the most part, not violently.
Right.
But it seems like this is kind of an interesting cultural thing. And it's not just in the U.S. And I don't know how much of it like kind of stems from reading Smiley's People. Did you read that? John le Carré?
Mm-mm.
It's a class. I mean, it's, you know, one of the top three or four spy novels ever written, probably. But it all starts it starts and also includes a lot of stuff that has to do with the emigre communities from the Baltic states and Russia, mm-hmm. and how the Soviet Union, how they trouble the Soviet Union in these kind of weird little ways, and the way the Soviet Union kind of reacts to them.
Right.
And then there's been, you know, some interesting, The New Yorker has had some interesting articles over the years sort of related to that kind of thing. There was one about somewhere in New York, maybe Queens, where some Rwandan refugees suddenly noticed that a person who was partially in charge of the genocide around where they lived suddenly shows up walking the streets of New York City and them trying to get justice. So anyway, it seemed just from reading the little blurb that it potentially had this kind of, this sort of subject of interest.
Well, and I think that's that was on the most recent season of Bosch, but in L.A. and with the Haitian.
I haven't seen that.
Like dictator's son. And I think this is absolutely a preoccupation of fictional works. Certainly, like 30 or 40 years ago, I feel like there was a cottage industry. That's a flip way to put it, but a cottage industry in thrillers and other fictional works that were about former Nazis.
Oh, yeah.
Just like being in Sheboygan or wherever. And of course, there was the Netflix series from last year concerning an alleged camp guard who, yeah. So I think that this is definitely something that is an ongoing preoccupation of the culture, and also the conflict between what the United States as a state, like as a diplomatic state, is going to feel about the actions of some of these emigres versus what like local law enforcement is supposed to do. They're about crimes that they are committing now and, you know, allegations about crimes that they committed before. It's an interesting conflict. Like the subject was interesting to me. I just felt like in this particular episode's case, the framework of kind of watching this correspondent start digging into the story and meet with his editor and like performatively read Freedom of Information Act filings on BART. I don't know. It just didn't cohere as well as I wanted it to, because it's really quite a scandalous situation.
Right. So that was, I think I had this a similar response. I guess I looked at it a little bit of a different way, which is that I felt as though the reporter was more out front in this one than usually.
Yeah.
Like it really was, there's, you know, one of the things I generally like about Frontline is there's not a whole lot of sort of like reporter preening or, reaction shots of the reporter looking sympathetic or devious or dogged or whatever. And there's a hell of a lot of it in this. I mean, it kind of felt like you're watching 60 Minutes at times.
Yeah. The active listening shots. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I like about Frontline is that they don't fall into that at times. But that being said, you know, the idea that Vietnamese anti-communist, you know, former soldiers are executing, people who they perceive as communists or as being anti-communists.
Or are talking about their existence.
Right. Is both crazy and, you know, I think...
Well, it's shocking. Like, it's scandalous given, if we are correctly concluding that the involvement of the State Department meant that it was the murder, it was the assassination equivalent of having diplomatic plates, I have a clip on that later, and there was kind of an interesting tie to present day culture. But I want to play a clip where they're talking to the initial victim that they're researching. They're talking to his sons about why Houston PD didn't follow up on what little evidence they had and why the case went cold.
Well, do you know if the Houston police translated this into English?
No. We gave them all the latest newspaper and they never gave us a feedback.
You gave them to them?
I gave it to them because since they have no witnesses, this is the only evidence.
It wasn't a lot to go on. A stack of old articles I would need to get translated. I tried to track down other reporters he knew.
Hi, I'm calling for Pham Kong Tu.
But their numbers no longer work. And even his old advertisers have closed down. These are the few details I can piece together. 7 shots, no shell casings, little forensic evidence, and no witnesses.
This part I thought was showed some promise because, I enjoy a nice processy, the reporter's going to crack the case. Like, go ahead, Scoop Thompson, walk us through it. That's fine. I also think that episodes like this, when they convert it to the audio version for the podcast, they actually work quite well. But this part brought up something that I kept thinking about for the first half of the episode, which is it wasn't even as strong as an implication, but it seemed like it was going in the direction of bias against, or not bias against, but apathy about a crime that would take place sort of intra one of these immigrant communities. Did you get the sense that that was a factor either in the story or in the reporting of the story?
Yeah. I mean, I do. I thought that in that, especially in Houston, it feels like later the implication becomes that, pressure was kind of put on people.
Right. Exactly.
Not to pursue it.
Versus them being like, it's too much trouble to get this translated.
Right. And, in the end, but I mean, that's, to be quite honest, that's great for a detective movie. But if somebody gets killed and your thing is, here's a whole bunch of newspapers you can translate, maybe you'll find a clue. Like, if you're a busy urban police department, I'm not sure that probably seems on the face of it really promising, a really promising use of time.
Well,
just to read a whole bunch of newspapers thinking that something's going to suddenly pop up.
Right.
Maybe if it could have been curated a little bit or something, the sons could have pointed.
Nice victim blaming. Maybe if he curated these. I'm joking.
But it's a weird.
You make a good point, though.
Like, it does seem, it's like something from a movie. Like, you're picking through it and like, oh my God, he wrote this article and this article and this article. Maybe it's the person that article is about.
But if you get this...
That doesn't seem to be the way most crimes go.
But if you get this case, if you catch this case and there's no witnesses or they say they're not saying anything and there's, you know, they police their brass, the shooters, and the only thing that the family can even tell you is like, yeah, he was getting threatened and it's probably because of these.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't, it's not that I necessarily think that they shouldn't have, but it's not hard for me to see without there being anything more sort of nefarious or racist or whatever, you know, a 15-year-old kid giving him a stack of newspapers and being like, yeah, it was probably one of these people he was writing about.
Yeah. No, you're probably right. Like, I mean, what do I know? I'm not a cop. But
how about some fingerprints?
Well, you know, yeah, but like if you don't have any of that, and this is going to be like what David Simon would have called a red ball, I don't know.
Right.
I'd probably at least try it, if only to make it look good. But that's why I'm a, you know, podcaster with a lot of opinions and not a detective.
And who knows what actually happened?
Yeah.
Because he doesn't really talk to anybody who worked on it. He just did. You know, the sons are like, oh, yeah, it never went anywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like, huh, I wonder why that is.
Well, and I think we find out later that what probably happened is maybe someone in HPD was like, all right, well, let's call whoever you call in a police department to try to get a translator. And they translate it and they tell you what happens and you put it in the file and you give it to the chief of D's and he's told to kill it by the State Department. Like, it wouldn't be the first time. So...
Yeah, or you get in touch with, you know, the FBI, like, national gang unit and, like, try and find out about Vietnamese organized crime or whatever. And they're just like, you know what, just, it's not a good avenue.
Yeah, well, and so I think the FBI got the same answer as we'll hear in clip 8.
The FBI files reveal a nationwide reign of terror. 7 murders, and dozens of attacks. Many targeting journalists who were critical of the front. But the FBI closed the case in the late 90s. And today, this unsolved wave of terror has been all but forgotten.
I mean, this is the thing about it. It's an unsolved wave of terror. Like, first of all, someone wanted it to remain unsolved. And second of all, like, it took them 50 years to close D.B. Cooper. And they only closed it. Like, they didn't close it. They just were like, we're not going to work on this anymore. But somebody was assigned to D.B. Cooper for, like, 47 years. This, they're like, well, that happened. And then they filed it.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Yeah, it's.
Yeah.
It's weird. Although it's not. I don't even really feel like this reporter, you know. To what extent does he solve it? You know, I mean, I don't like, I could even see the police getting as far as he does and not having that seem like much of anything.
Yeah.
Like what, like, even if like stuff was sort of current and ongoing, what in the end does he have that's kind of actionable?
Yeah. That's part of what felt unsatisfying. To me, this is just one of those shows where it's like, well, I think we all can agree on what probably happened, but we're not gonna get an indictment. We're not, like, The Hague isn't gonna do anything about it. So here we all are. Like, I don't know. Maybe this was my frustration, is that in typical Frontline style, it's like, here's a shitty, broken, corrupt thing you didn't even know about. But sometimes at the end, a Frontline will be like, you know, happily, or like giving some hope is whatever, vaccine doctor who's like, you know, we'll give you the outro that's like, don't, you know, don't just sit in the bathtub for the next 2 days being depressed. There is some reason to continue on. next time on Frontline, kittens, right. the hidden terror. Like, I don't know. It's.
I mean, I think that's a thing. Is it from the beginning when it's like this journalist was murdered and there's this thing called, you know, the Front, and then there's, you know, it just kind of lays out like this thing might exist, and then at the end it's like, yeah, well, it probably does. It seems as though it does.
Yeah.
And that's as far as it goes.
Well, and you have a number of people who are at least tangentially involved on camera kind of being like, yeah, that was totally going on. And then the reporter's like, he doesn't seem to have much remorse for his actions. And it's like, well, apparently he knows that nothing is going to happen to him, even if he's on camera admitting that he was involved in these death squads. So what does that tell you about this story? That it's one thing to uncover something, but then it just sort of sits there.
Right.
And once he gets to, this is about, I don't know, 53, 55 minutes long. But once he gets to the redacted pages of the file, halfway through, like, you're probably done. But listen for the name that he finds in the file, because I discovered a little bit of trivia about this guy that I will share. Here's clip 9.
A few months before his death, Dam Phong went to Thailand, investigating the Front's base there and its leader, Wong Kho Min. I'd focused on the Front's U.S. leadership, but when I open Min's file, everything changes. On his citizenship application, he assumes a Japanese cover name, William Nakamura. The home address he cites belongs to an advisor for the U.S. National Security Council. And a surprising name shows up. Richard Armitage, a top Pentagon official. The documents also show the Pentagon asked for Wong Kho Min's naturalization to be expedited. And their request is followed by 6 blank pages that have been redacted for national security reasons. It's the immigration application of a man who's been dead for almost 30 years. What possible national security reason would keep them classified now?
All right, 2 things about this, and I won't bury the lead. The first thing is that Richard Armitage's grandson, Ian Armitage, is young Sheldon. Did not know that.
Are you serious? Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's bizarre. And he's a really good actor. I first noticed him on an SVU episode. And all right, young Sheldon, I have no use for, but I hope he makes a lot of money and that his parents save it wisely for him. The second thing is, though, I think I've just identified another thing that felt unsatisfying about this episode of Frontline, to wit. He is talking about the expedition of this naturalization and the fake name and so on and so forth. But where the show goes from here is sort of continuing to try to confirm the existence of the Front and of K-9, and that that journalists and enemies were being targeted, which I think what I would have already stipulated. And it doesn't dig as much into like what Armitage's role was, or, you know, why would he in particular be interested in creating this new identity for this guy and making sure that it got rubber stamped ASAP. So that's the interesting sort of shocking part of it. And to tie it to Armitage, who is still living, I think, and did 3 combat tours in Vietnam, what are we really talking about here? Who are we really talking about in the State Department? Like, at least sort of give us a theory. And I don't feel like this episode does that. Am I being unfair?
No. And I think, you know, It's not hard to find parallels of other sort of anti-communist, you know, dissident groups that are supported largely by, you know, Republican regimes.
Yep. Sure isn't.
I mean, you can just like the Cuban expats down in southern Florida, for instance.
Sure.
Is probably the most prominent electorally. But yeah, so it's interesting. It's not entirely surprising, but it is a weird thing just to kind of mention and then not follow up on in some way, if only just to say, you know, we got in touch with the State Department and they had no comment.
Yeah.
And
this is not an organization that tends to get backed down by the FBI being like, shrug, we referred it to DOJ, and DOJ being like, shrug, it went to the CIA. Like, what is it that you're doing here? Like, I kind of want to see an episode about the making of this episode, because it doesn't go anywhere, because it has nowhere to go. So there is kind of a wheel spinning that is a little unusual for Frontline. I hope I'm not making you feel bad by like hammering on it, but
no.
This has been in it. You're like, eh, fuck you. This has been an interesting thought experiment vis-a-vis trying to diagnose like why. Like, I never feel, you know, like skipping down the road, rolling a hoop after watching a Frontline, but what about this one made me feel like unsatisfied versus dissatisfied? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think the other thing is that like the denouement is at the end is basically.
Oh, God. Yeah.
The reporter apologizing to one of the sons for the Brotherhood of Reporters not doing their job in sort of digging into what had happened to his father.
Yeah.
And then the son sort of, who's now like 45 or something, sort of weepingly says, thank you. As we see a reaction shot of the reporter looking grim and compassionate, you know, thank you. I've been waiting 33 years for somebody to say this. It's like, and I did it. Me.
Yeah, it just felt a little,
you know,
like
your humble reporter.
Cold justice-y. I mean, the thing is, I think the reporter was sincere in that moment. It's like, I think he really did feel that way, and it wasn't just like playing to the cameras, but it was also this kind of cheesy news maggy moment that is unusual for Frontline. And
would you have done it in that situation? Like, I don't, if I had made that, I think I would have left that out.
Yeah.
Cause it only seems self-aggrandizing. Like, I don't know how it contributes, unless you think that's really like an emotional climax. It's like,
I have nothing else to offer you. Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of like movement on the case, like, I mean, I sympathize with Thompson's, not plight, but like you have to put some kind of button on it, and it's this. And I don't think he was insincere, but the whole, it did really feel like an episode of Cold Justice where it's like we amassed all this extra information that still will give us no actual movement. But because TV loves closure, we're going to do this. Like, all right, that's on an Oxygen show. So I'm not going to mark off when Kelly, what's her name, is like talking to the family and everyone's holding hands and a focus pole shot. But from Frontline, no. And also let Will Lyman narrate it. It's what he does. It's all he does. He's good at it. Just get out of the way. Turn over your research. You don't really seem that comfortable being in the story, so don't. Also, it can, and this is not the fault of anyone involved, it's just like the passage of time, but this was made at a time when the active and dangerous devaluing of journalists all around the world, but especially here, was not nearly, that wolf was not nearly as close to the door as it is now.
Right.
So that for some reason, this, that part of it sat a little weirdly too. And that's not the fault of anyone. It's just,
yep,
just a weird thing.
The times.
Yeah. So, again, that is Frontline. It's from 2015. I think it's just available on the Frontline website, and we'll link to it in the show notes. Here we are again, hoping for an A,
yep,
squeaking in with a high B+.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of grade A content.
In local news today, bees. Mm-hmm.
Toby, what else are you working on, and where can listeners find it?
So we're sort of mid-season in Strange Arrivals, which is my podcast about the supposed alien abduction of Betty and Barney Hill in 1961. And you can catch that. It drops Tuesday mornings, first thing. I think episode 5 just dropped, so episode 6 will be next week. You can also find me on Crime Writers On, which drops every Monday, and on Twitter at TobyBallNH. And if you follow the Crime Writers On Facebook page, we each do a Facebook Live at 7 p.m. Eastern time. It's sort of our COVID programming while everybody's home.
Nice.
So on Tuesdays at 7, I do a Facebook Live, and it's kind of me monologuing to a certain extent, but hopefully people come and have comments or ask questions or whatever in the little comments on the side. So yeah, that's kind of the extent of my stuff.
That's plenty. Thank you for squeezing me in once again. I appreciate it.
It was fun.
Thanks for saying so.
Oh my God, my cat is going bananas behind me. I don't know if people can hear that, but I don't know what he's doing. All right. Sorry.
That's actually very on brand for a Sarah D. Bunting podcast product. Anyway, thank you and your cat for coming back. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Piper Weiss on Mary Tyler Moore's non-Sante Kimes true crime TV movie, Kevin Smokler interviews Phoebe Judge, and Allison Lohuff is back to talk about John Watson, DCI. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and the Gram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extras, so sign up today. My guest has been Toby Ball, and he's on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.